Chapter 20. One of our pleasantest visits was to Père Lachaise, the national burying ground of France, the honored resting place of some of her greatest and best children, the last home of scores of illustrious men and women who were born to no titles, but achieved fame by their own energy and their own genius. It is a solemn city of winding streets, and of miniature marble temples and mansions of the dead gleaming white from out a wilderness of foliage and fresh flowers. Not every city is so well peopled as this, or has so ample an area within its walls. Few palaces exist in any city that are so exquisite in design, so rich in art, so costly in material, so graceful, so beautiful. We had stood in the ancient church of St. Denis, where the marble effigies of 30 generations of kings and queens lay stretched at length upon the tombs, and the sensations invoked were startling and novel. The curious armor, the obsolete costumes, the placid faces, the hands placed palm to palm in eloquent supplication, it was a vision of gray antiquity. It seemed curious enough to be standing face to face, as it were, with old Dagobert I, and Clovis and Charlemagne, those vague, colossal heroes, those shadows, those myths of a thousand years ago. I touched their dust-covered faces with my finger, but Dagobert was deader than the 16 centuries that have passed over him. Clovis slept well after his labor for Christ, and old Charlemagne went on dreaming of his paladins, of bloody Roncesvals, and gave no heed to me. The great names of Père Lachaise impress one too, but differently. There the suggestion brought constantly to his mind is, that this place is sacred to a nobler royalty, the royalty of heart and brain. Every faculty of mind, every noble trait of human nature, every high occupation which men engage in, seems represented by a famous name. The effect is a curious medley. D'Avest and Massena, who wrought in many a battle tragedy, are here, and so also is Rachel, of equal renown in mimic tragedy on the stage. The Abbe Sicard sleeps here, the first great teacher of the deaf and dumb, a man whose heart went out to every unfortunate, and whose life was given to kindly offices in their service. And not far off, in repose and peace at last, lies Marshal Ney, whose stormy spirit knew no music like the bugle call to arms. The man who originated public gaslighting, and that other benefactor who introduced the cultivation of the potato, and thus blessed millions of his starving countrymen, lie with the Prince of Masserano, and with exiled queens and princes of further India. Gay Lussac the chemist, Laplace the astronomer, Larry the surgeon, Dessous the advocate, are here, and with them are Talma, Bellini, Rubini, de Balzac, de Marchese, Beringer, Molière and Lafontaine, and scores of other men whose names, and whose worthy labors are as familiar in the remote by-places of civilization as are the historic deeds of the kings and princes that sleep in the marble vaults of St. Denis. But among the thousands and thousands of tombs in Père Lachaise, there is one that no man, no woman, no youth of either sex, ever passes by without stopping to examine. Every visitor has a sort of indistinct idea of the history of its dead, and comprehends that homage is due there, but not one in 20,000 clearly remembers the story of that tomb and its romantic occupants. This is the grave of Abelard and Hellas, a grave which has been more revered, more widely known, more written and sung about and wept over, for 700 years, than any other in Christendom save, only that of the Savior. All visitors linger pensively about it. All young people capture and carry away keepsakes and mementos of it. All Parisian youths and maidens who are disappointed in love come there to bail out when they are full of tears. Yea, many stricken lovers make pilgrimages to this shrine from distant provinces to weep, and wail and grit their teeth over their heavy sorrows, and to purchase the sympathies of the chastened spirits of that tomb with offerings of immortelles and budding flowers. Go when you will, you find somebody snuffling over that tomb. Go when you will, you find it furnished with those bouquets and immortelles. Go when you will, you find a gravel train from Marseille arriving, to supply the deficiencies caused by memento cabbaging vandals whose affections have miscarried. Yet who really knows the story of Abelard and Hellas? Precious few people. The names are perfectly familiar to everybody, and that is about all. With infinite pains I have acquired a knowledge of that history, and I propose to narrate it here, partly for the honest information of the public, and partly to show that public that they have been wasting a good deal of marketable sentiment very unnecessarily. Story of Abelard and Hellas. Hellas was born 766 years ago. She may have had parents. There is no telling. She lived with her uncle Fulbert, a canon of the Cathedral of Paris. I do not know what a canon of a cathedral is, but that is what he was. He was nothing more than a sort of a mountain howitzer, likely, because they had no heavy artillery in those days. Suffice it, then, that Hellas lived with her uncle the howitzer and was happy. She spent the most of her childhood in the convent of Argentuol. Never heard of Argentuol before, but suppose there was really such a place. She then returned to her uncle, the old gun, or son of a gun, as the case may be, and he taught her to write and speak Latin, which was the language of literature and polite society at that period. Just at this time, Pierre Abelard, who had already made himself widely famous as a rhetorician, came to found a school of rhetoric in Paris. The originality of his principles, his eloquence, and his great physical strength and beauty created a profound sensation. He saw Hellas, and was captivated by her blooming youth, her beauty, and her charming disposition. He wrote to her, she answered. He wrote again, she answered again. He was now in love. He longed to know her, to speak to her face to face. His school was near Fulbert's house. He asked Fulbert to allow him to call. The good old swivel saw here a rare opportunity. His niece, whom he so much loved, would absorb knowledge from this man, and it would not cost him a cent. Such was Fulbert penurious. Fulbert's first name is not mentioned by any author, which is unfortunate. However, George W. Fulbert will answer for him as well as any other. We will let him go at that. He asked Abelard to teach her. Abelard was glad enough of the opportunity. He came often and stayed long. A letter of his shows in its very first sentence that he came under that friendly roof like a cold-hearted villain as he was, with the deliberate intention of debauching a confiding, innocent girl. This is the letter. Cannot cease to be astonished at the simplicity of Fulbert. I was as much surprised as if he had placed a lamb in the power of a hungry wolf. Hellas and I, under pretext of study, gave ourselves up wholly to love, and the solitude that love seeks our studies procured for us. Books were open before us, but we spoke oftener of love than philosophy, and kisses came more readily from our lips than words. And so, exulting over an honorable confidence which to his degraded instinct was a ludicrous simplicity, this unmanly Abelard seduced the niece of the man whose guest he was. Paris found it out. Fulbert was told of it, told often, but refused to believe it. He could not comprehend how a man could be so depraved as to use the sacred protection and security of hospitality as a means for the commission of such a crime as that. But when he heard the rowdies in the streets singing the love-songs of Abelard to Hellas, the case was too plain. Love songs come not properly within the teachings of rhetoric and philosophy. He drove Abelard from his house. Abelard returned secretly, and carried Hellas away to Palace, in Brittany, his native country. Here, shortly afterward, she bore a son, who, from his rare beauty, was surnamed Astrolabe William G. The girl's flight enraged Fulbert, and he longed for vengeance, but feared to strike lest retaliation visit Hellas, for he still loved her tenderly. At length Abelard offered to marry Hellas, but on a shameful condition. That the marriage should be kept secret from the world, to the end that, while her good name remained a wreck, as before, his priestly reputation might be kept untarnished. It was like that miscreant. Fulbert saw his opportunity and consented. he would see the parties married, and then violate the confidence of the man who had taught him that trick. He would divulge the secret, and so remove somewhat of the obloquy that attached to his niece's fame. But the niece suspected his scheme. She refused the marriage at first. She said Fulbert would betray the secret to save her, and besides, she did not wish to drag down a lover who was so gifted, so honored by the world, and who had such a splendid career before him. It was noble, self-sacrificing love, and characteristic of the pure-souled Hellas, but it was not good sense. But she was overruled, and the private marriage took place. Now for Fulbert. The heart so wounded should be healed at last. The proud spirit so tortured should find rest again. The humbled head should be lifted up once more. He proclaimed the marriage in the high places of the city, and rejoiced that dishonor had departed from his house. But lo! Abelard denied the marriage. Hellas denied it. The people, knowing the former circumstances, might have believed Fulbert had only Abelard denied it, but when the person chiefly interested, the girl herself, denied it, they laughed, despairing Fulbert to scorn. The poor canon of the Cathedral of Paris was spiked again. The last hope of repairing the wrong that had been done his house was gone. What next? Human nature suggested revenge. He compassed it. The historian says, "Ruffians, hired by Fulbert, fell upon Abelard by night, and inflicted upon him a terrible and nameless mutilation. I am seeking the last resting place of those ruffians. When I find it, I shall shed some tears on it, and stack up some bouquets and immortelles, and cart away from it some gravel whereby to remember that howsoever blotted by crime their lives may have been, these ruffians did one just deed, at any rate, albeit it was not warranted by the strict letter of the law." Hellas entered a convent, and gave goodbye to the world, and its pleasures for all time. For 12 years she never heard of Abelard, never even heard his name mentioned. As he had become prioress of Argentule, and led a life of complete seclusion. She happened one day, to see a letter written by him, in which he narrated his own history. She cried over it and wrote him. He answered, addressing her as his sister in Christ. They continued to correspond, she in the unweighed language of unwavering affection, he in the chilly phraseology of the polished rhetorician. She poured out her heart in passionate, disjointed sentences. He replied with finished essays, divided deliberately into heads and subheads, premises and argument. She showered upon him the tenderest epithets that love could devise. He addressed her from the north pole of his frozen heart as the Pouse of Christ, the abandoned villain. On account of her too easy government of her nuns, some disreputable irregularities were discovered among them, and the abbot of St. Denis broke up her establishment. Abelard was the official head of the monastery of St. Gildas de Rais, at that time, and when he heard of her homeless condition a sentiment of pity was aroused in his breast. It is a wonder the unfamiliar emotion did not blow his head off, and he placed her and her troop in the little oratory of the Paraclete, a religious establishment which he had founded. As he had many privations and sufferings to undergo at first, but her worth and her gentle disposition won influential friends for her, and she built up a wealthy and flourishing nunnery. She became a great favorite with the heads of the church, and also the people, though she seldom appeared in public. She rapidly advanced in esteem, in good report, and in usefulness, and Abelard as rapidly lost ground. The Pope so honored her, that he made her the head of her order. Abelard, a man of splendid talents, and ranking as the first debater of his time, became timid, irresolute, and distrustful of his powers. He only needed a great misfortune to topple him from the high position he held in the world of intellectual excellence, and it came. Urged by kings and princes, to meet the subtle Saint Bernard in debate and crush him, he stood up in the presence of a royal and illustrious assemblage, and when his antagonist had finished he looked about him, and stammered a commencement. But his courage failed him, the cunning of his tongue was gone. With his speech unspoken, he trembled and sat down, a disgraced and vanquished champion. He died a nobody, and was buried at Cluny, A.D.D. 1144. They removed his body to the Paraclete afterward, and when Ellis died, 20 years later, they buried her with him, in accordance with her last wish. He died at the ripe age of 64, and she at 63. After the bodies had remained entombed 300 years, they were removed once more. They were removed again in 1800, and finally, 17 years afterward, they were taken up and transferred to Pere Lachaise, where they will remain in peace and quiet until it comes time for them to get up and move again. History is silent concerning the last acts of the mountain howitzer. Let the world say what it will about him, I, at least, shall always respect the memory and sorrow for the abused trust, and the broken heart and the troubled spirit of the old smooth bore. Rest and repose be his. Such is the story of Abelard and Ellis. Such is the history that Lamartine has shed such cataracts of tears over. But that man never could come within the influence of a subject in the least pathetic without overflowing his banks. He ought to be damned or levied, I should more properly say. Such is the history not as it is usually told, but as it is when stripped of the nauseous sentimentality that would enshrine for our loving worship a dastardly seducer like Pierre Abelard. I have not a word to say against the misused, faithful girl, and would not withhold from her grave a single one of those simple tributes which blighted youths and maidens offer to her memory, but I am sorry enough that I have not time and opportunity to write 4 or 5 volumes of my opinion of her friend the founder of the Parachute, or the Paraclete, or whatever it was. The tons of sentiment I have wasted on that unprincipled humbug in my ignorance. I shall throttle down my emotions hereafter about this sort of people until I have read them up and know whether they are entitled to any tearful attentions or not. I wish I had my immortelles back now and that bunch of radishes. In Paris we often saw in shop windows the sign English spoken here, just as one sees in the windows at home the sign CI on peril francais. We always invaded these places at once and invariably received the information, framed in faultless French, that the clerk who did the English for the establishment had just gone to dinner and would be back in an hour with Monsieur by something. We wondered why those parties happened to take their dinners at such erratic and extraordinary hours, for we never called at a time when an exemplary Christian would be in the least likely to be abroad on such an errand. The truth was, it was a base fraud, a snare, to trap the unwary chap to catch fledglings with. They had no English murdering clerk. They trusted to the sign, to inveigle foreigners into their lairs, and trusted to their own blandishments, to keep them there till they bought something. We ferreted out another French imposition, a frequent sign to this effect: colon all manner of American drinks artistically prepared here. We procured the services of a gentleman experienced in the nomenclature of the American bar, and moved upon the works of one of these impostors. A bowing, aproned Frenchman skipped forward and said, "Que voulez les messieurs?" I do not know what "ou voulez les messieurs" means, but such was his remark. Our general said, "We will take a whiskey straight." A stare from the Frenchman. "Well, if you don't know what that is, give us a champagne cocktail." A stare and a shrug. "Well, then, give us a sherry cobbler." The Frenchman was checkmated. This was all Greek to him. "Give us a brandy smash." The Frenchman began to back away, suspicious of the ominous vigor of the last order, began to back away, shrugging his shoulders and spreading his hands apologetically. The general followed him up, and gained a complete victory. The uneducated foreigner could not even furnish a Santa Cruz punch, an eye-dash opener, a stone fence, or an earthquake. It was plain that he was a wicked impostor. An acquaintance of mine said the other day that he was doubtless the only American visitor to the exposition who had had the high honor of being Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.